So this brings us to our next session. The question here is, are we building a mindful society or a mindless one? We're living in a society that has become increasingly aware of acts of violence bred by intolerance. So how can we build a less violent society and a more compassionate society for ourselves, our children, and for their children in the future? Now is the time to build the foundation for a harmonious society for future generations to live peacefully. Teaching mindfulness in schools to develop emotional intelligence at an early age is paramount for the health and well-being of everyone. It is also time for us to rebuild trust and confidence in our communities, in each other, and also in law enforcement to ensure our safety and our security. So I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Venerable Dhammajiva, who I know spoke earlier today, so I know he needs no introduction, but he will be speaking about teaching mindfulness and compassion in schools, and building a less violent society for future generations. Please join me in welcoming Venerable Dhammajiva.
Sisters and brothers, my friends, we were discussing the mindfulness in two ways according to my perspective. One thing is curative and therapeutic, the other part is the preventive part. And from the West, we are learning a lot from how to find mindfulness as a cure for the present problems, physical and mental. And when you study the Satipatthana, the basic heart of Buddhist meditation, is talking highly on the preventive part, and it, good or bad, it appears like religious. It appears like spiritual. So therefore, it is like in the medical science, the therapeutic medicine and the curative, hygienic part. And in the medical science also, doctors are more popular than the hygienic and preventive part. Exactly, I find as a Buddhist monk, the presentation of preventive part need a great attention. And good part of the therapeutic is, it's highly prominent now, and it is virulent, and how mindfulness is going to give answer for the therapy, existing problems, mental and physical. And when it's introducing as a preventive, we can do two things. One thing is, before you've fallen into sick, mental or physical, you have to do mindfulness as a religious aspect or whatever may be. Or you can introduce mindfulness to children. So in that sense, I myself started in the age 26. And at that time, I had no much of a problem. So my teacher, it was a hell of a task for him to convince me, why should I be mindful? So some or the other, maybe my religious background, I started in 26. Late I found, if any person practicing at the age of 25, I feel like pay respect. If a person is practicing 20, it's a miracle. So that is the idea of mindful school. We call Satipasala. We'll give a silence contemplation to this presentation, and I'll give a little talk after that.
Sati in Pali has occupied a special place in the Buddha's teaching since 2600 years ago. In fact, mindfulness forms the basis and core teaching of one of the most respected and famous discourses in the Pali Canon, the Satipatthana Sutta. Mindfulness is also discussed in several other discourses included in the Theravada scriptures using the synonyms appramada, meaning diligence, for example. The Buddha's teaching on mindfulness placed it in a unique position, giving an unequivocal guarantee that the consistent mindfulness practitioner would ultimately reach full liberation or nibbana. Interestingly though, the past 3 decades has exposed mindfulness in a totally different dimension. The significant place mindfulness occupies in medical science today has special reference to mental health and emotional well-being. This aspect has been credibly testified by the substantial volume of ongoing neuroscientific research and publications in world-class journals. That mindfulness leads to demonstrable structural brain changes and that the latter will improve resilience, facilitate positive mind states, cultivate compassion, and manage emotions in a healthy manner is now a common understanding. Mindfulness has shown to have an expansive ability, facilitating adequate mind space, enabling the practitioner to be responsible ethically. Indeed, these neuroscientific discoveries have allowed mindfulness to occupy a unique place within a secular setting in the developed and developing world. Today, it is a commonly prescribed therapy and a non-pharmacological intervention used in a variety of conditions affecting emotional problems, mood and attention deficit disorders, and similar conditions. Prolific scientific research continues to highlight the value of mindfulness, addressing conditions affecting several systems of the body, in addition to the brain and the mind. This backdrop is essential to understand the genesis of Satipasala, which commenced in Sri Lanka during 2016. The aim of this program was to introduce mindfulness and to share the practice with students, teachers, principals, and the entire school community in Sri Lanka. Its architect, Venerable Uda Iregama Dhammajiva Mahathero, is a Theravada bhikkhu with nearly 25 years seniority who had personally experienced the benefit of mindfulness for nearly 3 decades. As an ardent practitioner of sati, even before joining the Theravada monastic order, mindfulness had always assisted him in a variety of situations as a layman and continued to offer exceptional support and insight as a practicing bhikkhu. The benefits of mindfulness became evident more recently after assuming responsibilities as the abbot, chief preceptor, and chief meditation master of an extremely dynamic and respected forest monastery in Sri Lanka, Mithigala, Nissaranavane, founded by the late Venerable Dhamma Nisanti or Mr. Asoka Viraratta. Since then, during his extensive meditation teaching career spanning about 2 decades, Venerable Dhammajiva had always based his teachings on mindfulness meditation. When commencing Satipasala in March 2016, introducing mindfulness to schools commenced very gradually as a grassroots initiative involving few schools that initially volunteered to join the program. It was the enthusiasm shown by the school authorities that enabled a pilot program to be conducted successfully in the preliminary stages of Satipasala. A necessary prerequisite to introducing mindfulness to schools was the preparation of simple instructional essays which illustrated the meaning of mindfulness in ways that were suitable for young children. The essays were written in all 3 languages used in Sri Lanka, Sinhala, Tamil and English, and teachers chose a language as appropriate for each school community. A lot of deliberation went into the policy aspect of Satipatthana since about 30% of Sri Lankan schools are multi-ethnic and multi-religious. The decision for adopting a secular approach in launching Satipatthana took into consideration these demographic realities in the education system of Sri Lanka. It was agreed that Satipatthana would therefore be an inclusive, non-religious, non-sectarian initiative enabling any student from any part of the country to join. A few preliminary evaluations designed to assess the receptivity of Satipatthana among students and teachers in initial pilot studies showed encouraging results. A team of volunteers who had practiced mindfulness themselves for many years conducted simple mindfulness exercises with students and teachers based on the instructional essays in the book, Satipatthana. Students and teachers had both experienced a certain amount of composure, emotional balance and well-being during and immediately after the programs. They had found they were less irritated and that they coped better with peers, parents, family members and with school events. The evolution of Satipatthana marked a significant milestone in late 2016 when the Ministry of Education joined in partnership and endorsed the philosophy of introducing mindfulness to schools in a secular manner. Since early 2017, teachers and principals of the national schools have joined mindfulness training programs in batches. School authorities, both government and private, showed a significant degree of receptivity for the mindfulness programs. Teachers expressed that mindfulness could offer remedies to aggression and violence seen in schools, and that it would contribute towards improved focus and better academic performance. They also felt that mindfulness expansion across sectors such as guiding, little friends, scouting, Sunday schools and similar activities will pave the way for kindness, compassion and pleasant relations among students of all ages. The Satipatthana initiative was also based on the understanding that mindfulness helps to transcend prejudices and to manage negative mind states, thus contributing towards prevention and healing of wounds in the mind. Indeed, this could pave the way for substantial harmony between diverse communities and those with a history of conflict. Leaders of different religious and ethnic groups have endorsed the philosophy and the inclusive approach of Satipatthana. A multi-religious, multi-ethnic group of religious leaders are functioning as a non-partisan, apolitical body supporting the mindfulness initiative in schools and universities. Satipatthana is moving forward steadily with students, teachers and entire school communities joining in with a great deal of interest in Sri Lanka.
Just to elaborate a little bit further into that, at the very first part of this mindful school or Satipatthana, we give 5 minutes essays or voice cut to the school, children at the school. And after 2 months, if the teachers are ready, they will send us invitation and then we go there as mindful facilitators or mindful trainers and take 1.5 hours. Early, that 40 minutes, give some demonstration and little walking meditation. Today, we had no much of chance to talk about this walking meditation, but it's a most effective one. And then another 30-35 minutes, bring to the classroom, give a guided meditation for about how to do sitting meditation and let them sit for 15 minutes. And the last 10 minutes, we collect their response, their experience. Remarkable. You all people need so much of evidence. Scientific evidence, all the kind of thing. But the children, if you give in the proper time, they respond in poems. They draw diagrams. And they dance. And I am so happy to see their response. But the thing is, elderly people must give the confidence. So yeah, we have to convince the elderly people, teachers, education department, governments, and you all, and convince the child, in a way, learn mindfulness as a hobby or mindfulness game. Because they have no reason to be mindful because they don't have stress. They don't have any frustration. So therefore, whenever you give, the way they give the response is really, we mean, the grassroots level of acceptance of it. And if the elderly people also going to give the consent, definitely we will take it into the national level, and then we wish to share it with all the other countries also. So we are, West and East has to come together. And elderly people and the young people has to come together. Meditation as the regimentation to the hobby level, we have to decide. So I use the term mindfulness games. More and more mindfulness games bring children, and ultimately once they learn it, definitely I think they will define it. They will teach us elderly people. So that is why I thought of come to a conference like that. Otherwise I personally do not like this kind of exposure. But I badly need your support. So I came, please give a second consideration and use it as a preventive measure rather than the therapeutic. Thank you very much for the attention.
Thank you, Venerable Dhammajiva. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Bunty Saranapala, who actually spoke earlier this morning, the urban Buddhist monk. He will be talking today about teaching mindfulness to police officers in Toronto, a simple meditation class that took the internet by storm.
Thank you, Mickey. Okay, here you go. I'm so happy to be here. Can I have some lights in the audience? Because I like to see some faces. Now it's good. are there any police officers here in the audience? No? Oh, it's okay. It's okay. So thank you, Venerable Dhammajiva, for this Satipatthana presentation, and that was amazing, and so I was so impressed to see this is happening now. And I have been doing this for a long time here in Canada. A lot of students come to our school, and also I get invited to go to schools to do such similar sessions. Those who are in my social media, you can see all the activities there. So today, I'm going to talk about, teaching mindfulness to police officers. And all I can do is just show you some pictures and tell you some stories. And I think I was fully aware of what venerable members of the Sangha talked about the mindfulness practice, and also what neuroscientists and psychologists were talking about the mindfulness practice. So, I think this one, right? Oh, this is my way of saying welcome. This little picture. Okay, so you see, there are a lot of pictures, so what I'm going to do is, how did it happen? How did I do it? And why meditation? Global perception about the police. impact of meditation. Canadian first responders and public shown a great interest in this program. So now, in Canada, I'm doing two programs. One is called Making Canada a More Mindful and Kind Nation. The other one is mindfulness-based suffering reduction. I know this mindfulness-based stress reduction. I changed the word stress to suffering. because of these programs I have been doing for some time in Canada, two police officers from the Peel Regional Police came to our temple to initially to build the community relationship. And when they came to our temple to talk about, you know, bringing some people to our temple to learn about Buddhism and meditation, and every time I say something, these two officers said, you know, we know everything about you. We are aware of you, what you're doing, so this is why we came here to see whether you can give a lecture on Buddhism and meditation to the new recruits. So I said, wonderful, nice. So we set up the date, but then in 2015, December 11th, my mother died. So I had to go to Bangladesh to attend my mother's funeral. And then we set up the date for January 4th, 2016. But I sent them an email, you know, I'm going away, but you can come, and we have other venerable monks. But when I came back, I learned they did not show up. So I sent them another email. I was told that you did not show up. Why is that? They said, because you were not here in town. So I said, well, I'm here at the temple now. We can, if you like, we can set up another day. So we set a day in March, and I thought maybe, you know, 10, 15 officers would show up. But when they were coming to the temple, I was so impressed to see about 35 officers coming to the temple. And now the people in the neighborhood and also in the Carter Road, they were so scared. What's going on here? So many officers in the temple. So, anyway, so I, you know, when they came, I talk about all the, you know, gave an introduction to Buddhism and meditation. And then before that, I was reading some online research papers. And one paper that I read, by research paper done by John M. Violanti, who is the research associate professor in University of Buffalo. And there, in this research, we see one officer who has been there in the service for 23 years. The policing is a psychologically stressful work environment filled with danger, higher demands, ambiguity in work encounters, human misery, and exposure to death. So, then the recommendation was, the intervention is necessary to help officers deal with this difficult and stressful occupation, he said. We want to educate them on how to survive 25 years of police work. They need to learn how to relax, I have underlined there, how to think differently about things they experience as a cop. There is such a thing as post-traumatic growth. People can grow in a positive way and be better cops and persons after they survive the trauma of police work. That is an important message. So after reading this, I thought, wow, you know, this meditation, this would work for them. So what I did was, you know, giving the lecture, and, you know, I normally, you know, I'm a monk of the 21st century, and that's why people call me the urban Buddhist monk. And so I take pictures, you know, and because picture tells everything. And so I also share some pictures in the social media. By the way, I got their permission, you know, before taking the pictures. I decided it's okay. So when I posted these pictures in the social media, Facebook, guess what? Within hours, people started sharing and sharing and sharing. And then even our community people called the temple. You know, there are so many offices at the temple. And even our abbot was not aware of this, you know, that I posted the pictures in social media. But then he said, yes, there are officers who came to learn about Buddhism and meditation. So this is the picture, you know, in the social media, people, this is what they have not seen. You know, especially when they think about the police officers, you know, all the negative things pop up in their minds. And when I posted these pictures, and I went through the comments again by the public around the globe, there are two things became so clear. You know, they are talking about, oh, officers are bad. They're because of the police brutality, and they believe meditation is good, and this will help them to reduce the police brutality. And if you want to read about this, you know, go online, still these are there, these pictures on social media. So then, you know, I just want to show some pictures, you know, how we were doing the meditation. People couldn't believe their eyes, the fact that having these guns and walls and everything, they are practicing meditation. And so, wow, this is something new. And I think this is what they have not never seen before. And now they think this is the new direction. And I was very happy to get the positive feedback from the public. And so now after this, people started talking about this a lot. So now, guess what? When I was doing this, and there was a lot of police brutality happening in Chicago, and also in Dallas, Texas. And then in CNN's Fariz Zakaria, in his GPS program, he picked up on this. So they called me, and I said, it's okay, you know, you can show the pictures. And they thought, wow, this is so powerful. And even he recommended that, suggested that it would be good for if Canadian police can do this, American police can do it too. So I was very happy to hear this from him. And so it appeared in a Europe and German magazine called View, and this became a powerful picture for them. And after this, the OPPs came down to our temple thanks to our mutual friend, Judith Hart, who talked to OPP officers. And they came down to the temple and said, oh, we also want to learn about this. We heard about this. Can you teach us meditation? I said, well, yeah, if you come, it would be nice. So then, you know, they came to the temple, and I did this program with them. And after this, paramedics have shown a great interest in this program. So I was invited to, do this session in the Niagara-on-the-Lake for some paramedics from the Niagara region. And then I was invited by the Toronto Police Headquarters. And so there I did this program. It was a bad day, by the way. It was heavily snowing. But despite that, these people showed up, and they expected more. So after this, I was invited to do the same lecture in the Toronto Police Training College. And then, you know, in the media, of course, they started talking about this. And you can see these officers. And then I got attention from the Morton Grove Police Department in Chicago. And this is interesting, you know, how they are saying, I say, hello, Bhante, I wanted to say thanks again to you for the presentation today. Everyone enjoyed it, and we received many positive comments later in the afternoon back at the station. Bhante, you are providing very valuable information. Some of the officers have pretty stressful lives, and this will help them manage it better. I know it will help me. You probably know this, but police officers will rarely ask for help until their problems get very bad. They are such good men and women. I'm glad we could give them something so useful. I also enjoyed our conversation, and I admire your faith and comments. Thanks. I'm looking forward to doing it another time. I enjoyed meeting you very much. So this is the police chief. And what do I teach? There's a sutra in the Sanyutta Nikaya. in this, it's called Sedaka Sutra. There, Buddha is saying that, I will watch after myself, I will watch after others. And monks, the establishing of mindfulness is to be practiced with the thought, I will look after myself. The establishing of mindfulness is to be practiced with the thought, I will watch after others. When watching after yourself, you watch after others. When watching after others, you watch after yourself. So anyway, so I talk about mindfulness meditation in this way. I am going to skip because I don't have much time. And so the goal of mindfulness meditation is to focus to quiet the mind in the present moment. So in this, what I do is I bring neuroscience, talk about Dr. Richard Davidson's three statements. We can train ourselves for positive change. Positive changes are measurable. Learn the new ways of thinking for the positive changes. So, of course, police officers have a lot of negative stuff. And in this, what I bring is Ajahn Brahm's four steps of mindfulness meditation. Present moment awareness, silent present moment awareness, and silent present moment awareness of breath, and then sustain your attention on the breath. So these four steps I emphasize, and they love it. And after that, I emphasize on the metta, loving kindness meditation. It's so beautiful to say this, you know, even I love the word Ajahn Brahm coined, kindfulness. And so there is, you know, the kindergarten song that I normally sing with them. It's called, row, row, row the boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. I said, this is, you know, what we are doing here. So I have changed that rhyme. I said, let us live, let us live, let us live a life. Peacefully, kindfully, let us live a life. We all love it. And so I have this thing, you know, there is a comment, Bhante Sarupala, you achieved your goal with us. You're making a more mindful and kind Canada. Yeah, so I just want to say, in Canada, we also have a mindful cop. So we, you know, yeah, this is from the York Regional Police. So we are working together, and I think that we are making a mindful society, mindful nation, mindful globe. So thank you so much. You just have to do it now. You're successful the moment you start. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bhante Sarupala. Kindfulness and mindfulness. It was beautiful, beautiful. The next speaker that I would like to introduce is Theo Koffler. She is an award-winning social entrepreneur and founder of Mindfulness Without Borders. She's a passionate advocate for mindfulness-based social and emotional learning in educational, healthcare, and corporate settings worldwide. And today, Theo Koffler is going to be talking about Mindfulness Without Borders and the role of secular mindfulness in developing social and emotional intelligence in youth. Please join me in welcoming Theo Koffler.
Great. I like the idea of the lights going up so I can see my audience. But first of all, thank you so very, very much. I'm so deeply humbled to be here, to address this audience, to be part of my brothers and sisters who've come from far away, my esteemed colleagues who have shared their programs, their science, their research, and to see and be part of you and know that whatever you are doing in the world, it's bringing such a better place, building a better humanity. So thank you, Dr. Pial, Walpola, Indy, the organizers, the volunteers. You all make this happen, and it's really a dream come true for me to be a participant here. So let me start with telling you that my role here is to talk to you about my own journey, how I came to mindfulness, and to also talk to you about the programs we develop to bring mindfulness and social-emotional intelligence first and foremost to youth and the adults that serve them. My own journey, as you can see here, I was 32 years old. I was living in Israel. It was the late 70s. And my brother and I moved there from Toronto as we were part of a group of North American corporate professionals who were invited by the Ministry of Finance in Israel to bring our North American best practices to the country, because Israel at that time was really striving to become part of the global marketplace. Coming from careers in drugstore retailing, our vision was to develop Israel's largest national drugstore, just as our father had done so in Canada. In many ways, I was really at the top of my game, but underneath the surface, I found myself struggling with the complexities of living in a country associated with violence and divide and conflict. The longer I was there, the harder I worked. It became more difficult to watch the us and them paradigm in action. And furthermore, growing up in Toronto, Canada, I had little, if any, competencies and experience to deal with the complexities of living in a country of divide. And as hard as I tried to deal with it, really, to really try and manage the stress that I experienced, in the end, I just couldn't. And eventually, the stress got caught up, or I should say caught up to me, and the country's divide became mine. And shortly after the birth of my second son, I was diagnosed with lupus. And really, my world turned upside down. Everything I knew had dissipated. It truly stopped me in my tracks. I went from an active, career-driven, athletic, ambitious, you name it, mother of two, to a woman dealing with a very serious health condition. And the more I learned about lupus and the more I learned about my health, I realized how much my internal stressors and my personal choices contributed to my overall well-being, and in this instance, contributed to my health condition. And so it soon became apparent, guess what, Theo, that if I wanted to get better, I would have to figure out a new way of living, a new approach to my life. I had to reassess my priorities. And thankfully, just as the universe was there to support me, around that time, a friend gave me a little book written by Thich Nhat Hanh. And it was called, and is called, and is today still on the bookshelves, Peace is Every Step. And it introduced me to meditation and mindfulness, and in hindsight, it really, truly changed my life. The wisdom in those pages put me on a path towards healing and actually laid the foundation for the very values that I live and breathe by. My professional life also did a 180-degree change. Inspired by the personal benefits of mindfulness and meditation, I began looking deeply and deeper into the field. I discovered that social-emotional learning and mindfulness were actually growing and emerging trends in education. And before long, I set my sights to a new sense of purpose. In 2005, I ventured into what would prove to be an incredibly rewarding career. Mindfulness Without Borders was born. I gathered a small team of dedicated teachers, practitioners together, and we decided to develop curriculum for youth as they transitioned to their adult lives that taught to the very social-emotional skills and mindfulness practices that I was missing when I was in my younger years. And more important, to help them navigate all of life's ups and downs, to navigate the challenges that they would eventually face. So the curriculum grew into this program called the Mindfulness Ambassador Program, which has now actually moved across the globe. And it's in so many different high schools and in classrooms and in health organizations, hospitals, and even police departments. And your mindful cop, John Carson, from the York Regional Police Department, he actually believed that mindfulness was important for his police academy, and together we developed a program, Mindfulness at Work, that sits in his police academy till today. So our foundational principles center on the recognition that while everyone is born with the capacity to experience a complex array of emotions, we don't always have the know-how, the skill set needed to manage these emotions. And that making a case for social-emotional learning and mindfulness in education. We owe it to our young people. Social-emotional skills are a highly critical but often overlooked part of the whole student development. We owe it to our teachers and the professionals that serve our students to pass on these important tools to the young adults with whom they serve. And this leads me to the present moment. When I consider the theme, the underlying theme of this conference, how can we build a less violent and more compassionate society for our children and their children in the future, I actually say it starts with self-awareness. Without self-awareness, we're unable to recognize, acknowledge, and take stock of the roles we play when it comes to interpersonal interaction, when it comes to environment and individual circumstance. Once we're self-aware, we can then figure out the appropriate action to take. And so we're dealing with really intense 21st century challenges that I say with more self-awareness, it will become possible to move away from perceptions, from limiting self-beliefs, from letting stress and anxiety manage our lives, and more into a place where we're able to cope, to build an appreciation and understanding for our differences as well as our similarities, and to build a common humanity. Self-awareness, or inner awareness, as my colleague Dr. Dan Siegel says, is a requirement if we want the ability to truly consider the differences and similarities that make up us all. So, in my opinion, this isn't an extravagance. This is actually a necessity. So my question to you is, why wouldn't we? Why aren't we incorporating these important skill sets and mindfulness practices to our global education system? So keep this question in mind, and I'm going to take you through a slideshow of a few photographs that have taken a place in some of the countries and locations that we've visited thus far. In 2007, we launched our educational program in select locations in Africa with the very goal of working with these communities and populations as they were reshaping themselves, moving away from past narratives and becoming aware of their full human potential. This photo depicts the Mindfulness Ambassador Youth Program in action. As you can see, and we do this everywhere we go, even in corporate environments or in police academies, we sit in circle, we facilitate, as we wholeheartedly believe that knowledge and wisdom is already in the room. It's a lived experience in all of us. We actually seed questions. We catalyze conversations. We inspire individuals to learn and grow and transform by reflecting on the very experience and insights that they embody. A primary goal of our program is to create human connection. So this photo here was taken at Hope North Vocational and Secondary School in a northern remote location in Uganda. And this school was in principle for former child soldiers, many of them orphaned. These two young men were participating in an activity that fosters the development of authentic connection, learning to speak eye to eye. But as former child soldiers, looking into the eyes of victims was forbidden. So what I find so incredible about this photo is that those two young gentlemen are actually trying to create connection. There's a willingness in them to explore a different way of being in relationship with each other. So this is a 5-day self-care workshop in Abuja, Nigeria, where we worked with about 100 educators from Teachers Without Borders. This photo depicts a mindful walking practice, but in this instance, we asked our Nigerian friends to walk with a sense of appreciation of what's around them, nature, in more of a contemplative way, because walking is the most primary and foremost mode of transportation. So walking wasn't new, but mindful walking was. So, and I also should mention to you that our programs are secular in nature, our mindfulness practices are secular in nature, so that we have the ability to share these practices across all borders, spiritual, geographic, cultural. And we never take a didactic approach to learning. We take a community approach. We learn what's going on in the field, and we try to the best of our ability to embrace the narrative that exists in these communities. We rely on the individuals, their gifts, and their talents to help us navigate the programs that are needed. And this was these two slides here were at schools in select locations in Kigali, all of them doing our programs, which were a 12-week intervention at that time, and participating in a fun and engaging way to open perspectives, to learn about each other, as well as to build community. And it's especially salient when you're in Rwanda, which experienced the 1994 Rwandan genocide, and all these students were survivors. So one of our virtues and primary focuses is the cultivation of positive virtues and human kindness and respect for the other person and listening deeply and valuing one's opinion and the others as equal. So we run our mindfulness ambassador program in so many different locations, but there was a time and place for us to come to researching our programs. So after 4 years in Africa, we came back to Toronto and we engaged with the University of Toronto Faculty of Social Work, and a team of researchers reviewed our program and demonstrated the positive outcomes that we actually witnessed on the ground. So the research demonstrated that our programs built self-esteem. They built skill sets for students to better cope with their challenges. It helped them to communicate more effectively, to develop healthy relationships with their peers, and finally, to manage their own internal and external stress. So here's a picture of a school, one of the Toronto Catholic School District Board schools that implemented our programs as part of this research. We're now in their 27 of their 32 high schools. So mindfulness has become part of their school culture. And oftentimes people ask me, give me a break. You really think that young people like to sit in a circle and talk about what matters to them most and even learn practices to stop and breathe? And I say yes. I say young people are thirsty for that. That's what I've seen in my experiences of traveling around the world. I can't even begin to tell you all the students that come up to us and say, thank you so much for letting me escape this very hectic life I lead, the need to achieve, and come and rest in my breath and find a sense of groundedness and experience well-being and strengthen my own mental health. So what we also do, I must add, is that we have curriculums that not just work on the development of skill sets, but also promote a level of self-inquiry and creativity. And here is a student in Redwood High School in Marin County who is answering a question, actually a questionnaire. And again, we really believe that asking essential questions is what really matters, because it draws our attention to the important things in life. And it sparks curiosity. And here, this student is responding to a question there I think there were three questions. What inspired you today? What touched your heart today? What challenged you today? Bringing the student into the moment and beginning to feel a sense of gratitude for his or her life. So that's what we do. We create interconnection. This photo is students are participating in an activity that acknowledges the web of human connection, making caring for others an important priority. So we're celebrating 10 years. We're in 14 different countries. We now have online curriculum that's called Rethink Digital Kit for anybody who's interested in activities. There's 100 of them, only 15 minutes, and they help youth shift perspectives, build an understanding of our common humanity, challenge assumptions, and break down biases and promote a more compassionate understanding of the world. So I stop with saying to you this quote from His Holiness the Dalai Lama: we cannot achieve world peace without first achieving peace within ourselves. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, Theo. I'd like to take a moment now to actually invite all of our last three speakers, Theo Koffler, Bhante Saranapala, and Venerable Dhammajiva, to have a seat over here so we can begin our next Q&A session. Questions, comments, challenges? Oh, right there? Okay, yes, please.
Yes, I am a Bhikkhuni Than Châu, was born in Vietnam, but in Toronto I am known as Dr. Dang. A family physician has been practicing for 36 years, mostly with the boat people. So I work with people with post-traumatic stress disorder before the term was invented. I'm just curious, in Sri Lanka, is there any diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactive disorder in children?
I don't have experience particularly about this attention, this thing. But I met one of the doctor. He came and he told 10% of our school children have a stomachache. And they don't know why. Then I asked him, why did you come to me? He told, answer is with you. You have to teach them mindfulness. So they are in such a stress for the grade 5 exam. So their parents and their teachers are forcing them in such a way. So they are so much stressful. So attention is maybe really disturbed. But when myself as a student, there was no such computer exam. So definitely we are developing that kind of a mental diseases among the children. But attention deficiency disease, specifically, I do not have data for the moment.
Yes.
Hello, and thank you very much for your presentations. My name is Reza. Brief background, I actually just quit my job. Yesterday was day one of being unemployed. The idea behind it was I quit so that I could focus on helping others. I created a YouTube channel called Resonate Coaching, and it's dedicated to paying all my gratitude and my experience forward to the millennial demographic. So all of your presentations really, really resonate with me. I am curious with regards to the Mindfulness Without Borders. You know, how does someone like me try to contribute or join such efforts? Something like that. Like, I'd love to be part of that. I'd love to see how I can go about contributing to that along with my own journey.
Well, first of all, congratulations for the decision you made. I'm hoping it's warmed your heart and opened your vision to really realize some new dreams. How to get started, set your intentions, identify what it is you'd like to do, and know that there are so many different organizations and people that are doing fascinating work. If you're interested in Mindfulness Without Borders, as they say in Hebrew, bevakasha, please get in touch. Happy to speak to you afterwards and see where your true interests lie and how we can help support your way. Because I believe in philanthropy. I think the goodness that we can share in our hearts has a ripple effect beyond anything that we could ever dream about. So I hope that satisfies your answer, your question.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we have one question up there.
Hi, my name is Sherry. I've been a little bit involved in bringing mindfulness into the schools in Ontario. And from what I've seen, actually just really in Richmond Hill, has concerned me somewhat. To the extent that Nowadays, anybody can hang up a shingle and say they're a mindfulness teacher. I've seen a program come through the schools where educators are being given, I think it's been a 24-hour course, and then told, go and now teach the children. And I have seen things that have caused great concern. So I'm wondering, especially Theo, what your perspective is on this. If you'd like to see some kind of a professional community being arranged so that the standards are contained at a certain level.
Well, thank you for that very important, essential question and your observation. It actually is true. There is an underlying vibration, that is looking seriously at what are the prerequisites, what are the protocols that should be systemic and that should translate across all schools, that creates programs that really do provide an effective result, an outcome. So I think with any new trend, anything new, especially emerging in education, it takes time to identify that, to explore it. But and I think that will happen. For us at Mindfulness Without Borders, we've been very, very dedicated in ensuring that we're not just handing over a program, but that there's a cultivation of skill sets and a training and a certification program and a mentoring program and an updating program, so that all along the way there's a support mechanism that develops the teacher's skill sets to be able to provide the practices and the curriculum in a way that's authentic and that shows up as being ethical and integral. So it is a concern. It's a concern of a lot of us. And I believe over the next few years we will be looking to ways to ensure that there's more protocol. So I would say for anyone who might be educators in the room or interested in programs, I would say maybe look to these programs and see whether they have some type of research, whether these programs have actually shown positive student outcomes, whether these programs actually meet the expectations, the graduate expectations of the school. And if of all those sort of are check marks on that list, then I would feel if the training is substantial, then the program with the training should prove to be positive. So thank you, though, for that question.
For me, I have been conducting this mindfulness sessions for students for many years. And sometimes I go to high schools and sometimes the teachers bring the students to our temple. So I have a lot of positive feedbacks from the teachers as well as from the students. And there are students, who look forward to coming back to the temple to do the meditation. And now what we are teaching, especially when students come to our temple or when I go to schools, I tell them, I'm not here to convert you into Buddhism. I make sure that this is not about Buddhism. And I always emphasize, this is good for you. You be whoever you are, but all you have to do is just going back to your positive qualities. Now, when I go there, sometimes I do little exercises like, let's say there are two friends who have known each other for 3-4 years. And then I say, okay, you look at your friend and just tell me 3 nice things about your friend. And it's so fun for them. So I said, look at your friend and just say something nice. He's funny, he's so nice, he's kind. Another person also says something similar. And when I continue doing this, I do this to make them become mindful of their positive qualities. And then we do this loving kindness meditation, like, you know, thinking positive thoughts. I say sometimes all the students repeat after me, so may I be, may they also say, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be free from all sufferings and pains. At the beginning, they find it kind of, you know, funny. They giggle. I say, it's okay, giggle. That's a giggle meditation. So, and then at the same time, loving kindness meditation. And we do this for 10 minutes, and you won't believe the classroom, the shrine room, is full of positive energy. You can see, like, you know, the happiness, big smile on their face. And then, you know, they, before leaving, they make sure to take a picture with me. They say, we want to share this with my parents. And so I received many feedbacks from the teachers too. They say, oh, my students are highly talking about this. So, you know, I think this is what we need to give to the next generation. You know, this is the fundamental education. Mindfulness has to be taught to everyone. It doesn't need a religion, although it's coming from the Buddha. He's the one who systematized this technique for the liberation from all sufferings and pains. So now imagine in our Sunday school, I was very happy to see Bhante, your presentation. Like in our Sunday school, we do this breathing exercise and loving kindness meditation. Who are these kids? From age 4 to 17. And after doing this, when they go home, you know, parents in the emphasize, can you do that loving kindness meditation you do with the principal sadhu? They call principal sadhu, principal Bhante, the principal of Sunday school. So before hitting the bed, they close their eyes, they take a couple of deep breaths, and they do this loving kindness meditation, and they feel very happy, positive, with a happy mind, they go to bed. And so I hear a lot of positive things from the parents, and of course friends, teachers, and students. And so I think mindfulness practice is exploding in Canada right now.
I wish you were my Sunday school principal.
We've got two questions.
So I would like to present 3 points after this response. One thing is presenting this mindfulness in a secular way. I am being a traditional Buddhist monk. I have complaints why you are not giving it in a religious way. But I understand right from the beginning it must be secular. Second thing is, I respect Sir Baden-Powell, Sir Baden-Powell, who started the scouting. They started with the first thesis, be diligent. And relationship between the mindful school and the scouting is almost parallel. That's the only organization I found that we can copy. And being a Sri Lankan, I have the second one, that is the Sunday schools. So I am begging the Sunday school principals, like Venerable Sanrapada, please give me a chance. So introduce this to the curriculum. And that is the way we have to learn from the already established organization and how to introduce this reductionist method to the global system problems. So it is a kind of a thing, as you mentioned, Kofler. We have to learn. We have to come with the new dimension. We have to come with the new curriculum. We have to come with the new valuation. So whenever we ask the response from the children, after giving a 1.5 hours of facilitation, it's also an ethical question. Can we question a child and get a feedback? So then we have to go through this ethics and kind of thing. Then only we visited the minister. telling that this is the point we need your authority that he gave. And now we have so much of written response and so ethical, aesthetic, so even the minister is happy. So you all have to evident it and give the support to make it that mindfulness as a school subject, but even then are we going to put marks? Are we going to measure children from the mindfulness? That is out of. So therefore we are in a transition in this burning world. So mindfulness is giving not only the curriculum, the teaching material, not only the methodology, not only the evaluation, not only the how to go with the existing organizations, and therefore we people working has to really learn from these students. Therefore this question is quite relevant for the present, I would say.
We have two questions from our live streaming audience.
We've had a number of questions asking for some reporting regarding any challenges or sensitivities that you would share with the watcher, listeners, regarding how to bring mindfulness to various cultures and religions that you've come in contact with. So if there's anything you'd like to share, there's an interest in hearing about this.
I think that for our work, first of all, thank you for that great question. For our work, we are so careful to really put our ear to the ground and to be respectful for the various cultures and spiritualities in the countries that and the populations that we've served. And that's a huge, huge priority. So that we're not making an assumption of what needs to be taught, but rather what is needed in the community. So that takes us away from bumping up against any challenges that might come across if we assume that what we're bringing, the qualities of that we're teaching, open-mindedness, emotional balance, navigating triggers, that what we're teaching actually is a complement to what, in fact, is happening in the community. So as long as we're respectful for that, for the human differences and the similarities, we really have not faced, actually, in our 10 years of growth and development, other than one student issue that we had where mindfulness was too difficult for that student. It brought up too many negative emotions. But other than that, we really haven't bumped into any major challenges that detoured our focus and vision.
Well, I think one thing that I have to emphasize on, after teaching meditation to the police officers, I have been receiving invitations from different organizations. And at the beginning, they have shown a great interest in the program. And later on, they cancel it for giving a reason like, you know, maybe we will try some other time. So I was kind of curious to know, like, you know, in the beginning you have shown a great interest and later why cancellation? So I talked to some friends and they said, well, because Bhante, you're a Buddhist monk. So maybe they are concerned that you might be bringing Buddhist religion and or converting them. This is the one I think the major concern that I have. But that's why right at the beginning I tell people, you know, I am not here to convert anyone. You be whoever you are, but understand that we all are human beings. Although I'm a Buddhist monk, or although you're a layperson, or Catholic, or Christian, or Muslim, or Hindu, or Jew, but, you know, let go these labels. Just assume yourself as a human being. When you take yourself as a human being, of course, as a human being, we all get upset. We all are angry. But here we are teaching a technique, a mindfulness technique, how to overcome this problem. So when I explain this, then they feel so relieved. So I think this is the only concern that I had. So I think this is also going, maybe it would be much easier for you because you're a layperson and they can easily connect with you. When they talk to me, they say, I'm a Buddhist monk. So, but when I say, I'm not just a Buddhist monk, I'm an urban Buddhist monk, they feel connected. They feel, you know, comfortable. Oh, that means we can connect with you. We can talk about everything. When I say, you know, I'm in the Instagrams, Facebook, and Twitter, I say, why? Really? Then they feel very comfortable.
So to add different perspective to this one, when we are present in this Satipasala or Mindful School, equally we had the multi-ethnic group discussion. That is religious masters, Catholic, Hindu, Muslims, and we get together. And the Bishop Chigera, he came and he told, I am so happy to give the full support. Bhante, you are going to give it with a secular kind of a presentation, but you, even if you are going to give it with the Buddhist principles, we are going to support. Because the whole world is seconding this idea about the mindfulness. And last session, we are having regular sessions among the multi-ethnic groups, not with the students, but with the religious leaders. And there was one Swami, Darshan, he came and he told, introducing mindfulness to the Sri Lanka, Bhante Dhammaji is better off because 70% of students are coming from Buddhist families. There is another 30% about the other religious people. So we being the leaders, we must give the full support to this, telling this is not a convention from the Buddhist, some religious to the Buddhist, but this is a mindfulness. So I took the mic and told that teaching mindfulness to the Buddhist is the most difficult part in the world. That is the most missing thing. No salt in our food. So being I am a senior monk, I told the Swami, thank you very much, but don't take it to grant that even the 70%, I have to really, really do the groundbreaking work. So therefore all the other support also very, very important. That is why I say, more than the impression of the children, the elderly people, those who know this burning problem, leave aside all this sectarianism, religious, ethical, and just come to this common ground of the mindfulness. And whenever the parents and the children, parents and the teachers giving some kind of a confidence, slowly, slowly, children will come. So therefore, as you mentioned, it takes time. So we are in a transitional period, so we have to learn rather than teach. So therefore, we use the term mindfulness facilitating rather than teaching. Thank you.
Thank you.
The last question is for Theo. There's a person wondering whether or not you've introduced your program in Israel and what the impact was.
Well, I have to say that part of our program was developed by two wonderful artists from Israel when we actually launched in Africa. Our work now is being translated by certified facilitators that have come through our programs. My dream now is to go back to Israel, actually, and to really do something fundamental there, which looks like attracting a larger group of educators and health professionals and doing certification training. So outside of the one person who has been a certified facilitator, we aren't there in the kind of way that one day I hope we will be. But everything does take time. You know, you can't be in all places around the world. But we are looking to go there. Again, one of the things that holds us back is all our programs are translated into the language of the country. So we're in English. We've adopted. We have a Spanish translated curriculum. We have someone who's translating the curriculum right now in French. And now I'm looking for someone who will help us to do the translation of our curriculum in Hebrew. And once we have that, that will open the gate. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'd like everyone to join me in giving our wonderful three speakers a round of applause.